This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. School shootings have become a sad fact of life in recent years. Today we'll revisit one that's often forgotten.
This is Neil Spelson, Red Rover, on the University of Texas campus.
This is a warning to the citizens of Austin. Stay away from the university area.
Stay away from the university area. There is a sniper on the university tower firing at will.
In August of 1966, a student and former Marine named Charles Whitman ascended to the top of the tower that housed the University of Texas main library and began shooting at people below. 15 died as a result of the university attacks, including an unborn child. 31 others were wounded. Hours earlier, Whitman had killed his wife and mother in their homes. He was eventually shot to death by police. Much has been written about Whitman's crimes and his troubled life, but a new documentary tells the story from the point of view of those in Austin who experienced the 96-minute ordeal. It's called Tower, and director Keith Maitland tells the story in an original way. He combines archival film and new interviews with an animated portrayal of the events. The film is based in part on a 2006 oral history by Pamela Koloff, which ran in the Texas Monthly magazine. Keith Maitland is a longtime Austin resident who graduated from the university. He directed the Emmy-nominated film The Eyes of Me about four blind teenagers and was an assistant director on NBC's Law & Order for 7 seasons. Tower premieres on Independent Lens on PBS Tuesday, February 14th. Well, Keith Maitland, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's go back. August 1st, 1966. Set the scene for us. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was a Monday, and it was the second session of summer school for the summer. And by all accounts, it was a typical hot, clear Monday morning. You know, in our film, we start with the story of Claire Wilson and her boyfriend, Tom Ekman. They're incoming freshmen who are taking summer school classes. They just got out of an anthropology test. They went over to the student union, to the Chuck Wagon, which was a cafeteria. And Claire and Tom, you know, were just having a regular Monday afternoon. They needed to walk across campus to put a nickel in the meter. And while they were walking across the big open plaza under the tower, the South Mall, a shot rang out and it hit Claire and she fell. And then a second shot rang out and it hit Tom in the neck and he fell beside her. And from that point forward, our story unfolds, which is the story of dozens of people being shot, hundreds of people being in harm's way, and thousands of people watching this horrible situation unfold with no idea what actually is happening, because the gunman, a sniper at the top of a 27-story tower, can't be seen, he can't be heard, and nobody knows what he wants or why he's doing it. They just know they need to find a way to survive and get through what turned into over an hour and a half tragedy.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. And this is part of a live radio broadcast that is preserved from that day. A guy named Neil Speltz. You want to just explain a bit about him and what we're going to hear?
Yeah, Neil was just a news director working at the local TV/radio station downtown when he heard it on the police scanner. Neil ended up getting into a station wagon that was equipped with a mobile transmitter, and he broadcast live from the scene. You know, his expectation as he was driving towards the campus is that he'd be reporting on an event that was already over, on a crime that had been committed. But he found as he pulled onto the campus that the shooting continued all around him. And so his kind of first-person perspective, his news reporting, became the voice of the event. And we're very lucky to have his reporting from that day to use within the film.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of this. This is from the film Tower, directed by our guest Keith Maitland.
He knocked a boy off a bicycle. He shot windows out of the Texas Union. More ambulances are screaming up and down the university drag, and the ambulances are apparently carrying those persons who we had reported as lying on the sidewalk, shot in front of the varsity theater and other buildings along the university drag. The university area has been cordoned off, and so far we've had reports of people being shuttled to the hospital via ambulances from practically all the funeral homes in the city.
And that is the radio reporter, news director, Neil Speltz in 1966, narrating the shooting at the University of Texas Tower. That's from the film Tower, directed by our guest, Keith Maitland. you can sense in that broadcast the terror of the situation. I mean, no one knew what to expect or how big it was or what exactly was happening, but it was obviously terrifying. This came at a time when random shootings were not common. I mean, people today have experienced so many of these. And I'm wondering how you think that affected the perceptions and reactions of people on the ground, students, teachers, others.
Well, you know, I've talked to hundreds of people who were there that day. And one of the things they always want to make clear is how unprecedented this was. Everybody who was there had a moment of realization when they recognize that they really didn't know what was happening at first. And then when they did realize, they had a decision to make. You know, one of the people we interviewed said she thought it was fireworks left over from the 4th of July just 3 weeks earlier. We live in a world today where you hear a loud sound that sounds like a gunshot in a public space, and it doesn't take long to kind of assume that there's something happening that you don't want to be a part of, to protect yourself, to run and hide. But in 1966, on this, you know, hot Monday morning here in Austin, people were surprised. They were confused. And so it made the sniper's job a lot easier to catch people unaware. And there were curiosity seekers who actually came towards campus thinking, I've never seen something like that. I want to get a look at what's happening, which is something you hope doesn't happen in situations like that today.
Yeah, it was a new, an unprecedented event for just about everybody. And although it's interesting, this was within 3 years of the Kennedy assassination, which involved a sniper a couple hundred miles away up in Dallas.
Yeah, and the specter of the Kennedy assassination, you know, loomed large over the Tower shooting and people's reaction to it, both here in Texas and across the country. You know, Austin didn't want to end up being seen the way Dallas was after the Kennedy assassination. And I think that's a big part of the reason why this history has gone kind of unrecognized for the last 50 years.
Yeah, you know, I started at the University of Texas 5 years later, and it was never talked about. There was no plaque. There was no memorial. I can only remember one conversation in 4 years there about it, and that was from a woman who happened to have been there.
The idea that this was never talked about, that's something that began really the day after the shooting. You know, the University of Texas shut down for one day, and they cleaned up the blood. They spackled as many of the bullet holes as they could find, and then classes resumed. That year, 1966, there was no mention of the Tower shooting at graduation. There's no mention of it in the school yearbook. There was no memorial to the students. It really was pushed aside, pushed into the shadows, and people were encouraged to move forward and not linger in this terrible, in the terrible tragedy of that day. And looking back, I think that was a mistake. And I think that cost people who were there that day, people who were traumatized by the event, it cost them an opportunity to deal with that trauma.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a bit more as we meet some of these folks. I want to meet one of the police officers, Ramiro Martinez, who was actually off that morning and when he heard of the events, reported to the campus. And what we'll hear here is him describing making his way onto campus. And these are the actual words of the young officer Martinez. They're voiced in the film by the actor Louis Arnett. Let's listen.
I tried to keep myself from being able to see the top of the tower because I knew if I could see the top of the tower, the sniper could see me. I ran until I got to the South Mall by the Jefferson Davis statue. There were wounded people and dead people. People whose conditions I did not know lying there on the sidewalk. Pregnant woman that was twisting and wilting in the hot sun.
And that's actor Louis Arnett voicing the words of police officer Ramiro Martinez from the documentary Tower, directed by our guest Keith Maitland. And the pregnant woman that he refers to, of course, is Claire Wilson. You know, this might be a moment to talk about the technique of you telling the story here, because we're hearing the actual words of Ramiro Martinez, who was an officer there. but they're read by an actor, and people are seeing this on the screen in a kind of animation. You know, the standard documentary filmmaking technique is you rely on archival footage and then contemporary interviews with folks who remember the events. Tell us about your approach to telling this story.
Well, the thing that always struck me about this story is how long the shooting lasted and how many people were impacted.
Which was so, just over an hour and a half, right?
That's right. The shooting went on for 96 minutes, and that's a tremendous amount of time. I mean, when we think of gun violence, you think of it happening in a matter of moments or seconds or even split seconds. So to think about it in terms of 90-minute blocks is it's a different kind of event. I wanted to kind of steep the audience in that time period and in what it felt like on that hot day to be a student, to be Ramiro Martinez or Neil Spels or Claire Wilson, trapped there, being held hostage by the sniper and being oppressed by the heat and feeling and hearing those gunshots all around them. And so the goal was to create an immersive experience through this documentary.
A compelling part of the film is when we see Claire, who is pregnant and seriously wounded, lying on the South Mall of the Texas campus. A young woman named Rita comes up and just crawls up and sits next to her and comforts her and keeps her talking. Talk a little bit about her and that part of the story.
I love talking about Rita because it's really her story that made me want to make this film. What Rita does that day is, in my estimation, the most humane and the most heroic action really I've ever heard of. You have to realize Claire is laying at the center of this exposed plaza, which is about the size of half a football field, and she's right in the middle.
And it's right under the tower, right?
It's directly under the tower. It couldn't be a more ideal target. And so nobody can get out there to help Claire without just being completely open and at risk, for a long time to get out there and to get back. But about 20 minutes into the shooting, Claire recalls a redheaded co-ed come running up, and she comes in and she stands over Claire and she asks her, "What can I do to help you?" And Claire tells her to get out of there, that it's not safe. And as gunshots, you know, continue to ring out, Rita doesn't go and run for cover. She hits the deck. She lays there by Claire's feet. And for the next hour, Rita lies there completely exposed on this plaza, on this mall. And she talks to Claire. Claire credits her for keeping her conscious with her questions and her conversation. And she's a comforting figure who gives completely of herself while risking everything just to help her fellow human being. And when I read that story in the Texas Monthly article 10 years ago, that was the moment that it had already been bubbling up. I thought somebody should make a movie about this. But when I got to that story, I said, I need to be the person to make a movie about this because this is just everything to me. This is what it is to be a person. This is what it is to be a hero.
Well, one of the stories that runs through this is the story of Claire Wilson, who an 18-year-old woman who was pregnant and was shot on the South Mall near the University of Texas Tower. Her boyfriend lay dead next to her, but she was seriously wounded. And we're going to hear a remarkable story here about a guy named John Fox. He has the nickname Artley. Just tell us who he was and how he got to the campus that day.
Yeah, Artley was a 17-year-old incoming freshman. He was taking summer school to get English out of the way. But he's from Austin. He grew up here just a few miles from the campus. And on the day of the shooting, he had just gotten out of class, was hanging out with a friend, James Love, in his freshman dorm just off campus. And they're listening to the radio, and they heard about the shooting on campus. And like two adventurous 17-year-olds, they decide to head towards the action on campus to see what's going on. Of course, neither one of them have any idea of what they're walking into.
Right, and then they end up in a situation where they're seeing people who've been shot lying around, including Claire, who is wounded and pregnant, lying out in the open in this heat. And Artley eventually, with his friend, musters the courage to go and rescue Claire. And we're going to hear a clip from the film where that happens. And what we're going to hear is the young Artley, in the voice of actor Seamus Bolivar Ochoa, describing what's happening. And then, and I think this is a great moment in the film, we're going to hear a seg to the real Artley recalling the events in an interview decades later. This clip begins with the wounded Claire lying on the mall in the voice of actress Violet Bean.
I just remember looking up at the sky. It was so blue. And just thinking, I guess this is it. I guess this is the end.
That's when I decided to go out there. And we had to move fast. We knew that. You can see, there was a camera. Time moves strangely, slowly. I grabbed Claire's feet. James grabbed Claire's arms. I've never been more scared.
I've never been more scared. And we ran him off. We ran her into safety to behind the hedge and set her down. And other people took her where the ambulances were. There's a cold spot that I can feel on my back right now. And when I think about it, it's about the size of a grape. It's halfway up my spine. It's halfway between my shoulder blades. And it's the place I expected the bullet to come in.
And that was John Artley Fox recalling the events on the University of Texas campus in 1966 when a sniper shot dozens of people and he managed to rescue Claire Wilson, who was wounded on the Texas campus. That's a remarkable moment there. And you make the decision later on in the film to bring in the voices of these participants in modern times when they're actually remembering them. You want to just talk a little bit about when you do that and why?
Yeah, we kind of made a decision that we would present that first hour through the artifice of animation and in this style and in this technique that would really place people in 1966 on that hot day. But it never lost meaning, and it never left our attention that these real people exist, they live in the world today, and they've been carrying this story with them for 50 years. And so the clip you just played, you hear both Claire and Artley in the moment that we do what we call the handoff, from the young actors portraying them in animation to the current day live action interviews that were actually the first step in my process in making the film.
The shooting here went on for a long time, an hour and a half. How did the police respond?
Well, you know, they had never done any sort of training for this. For a little bit of background, this is before the development of SWAT teams. This is before, police tactics have advanced to the point that they are certainly today. Austin is kind of a sleepy college town, and Austin's police force really isn't prepared for anything even remotely like this. The police brass, their initial reaction was to set up a perimeter around the campus. And so they kept people from approaching campus and they did their best to shuttle people to safety who were near the perimeter. But there was no concerted effort, at least within the first moments of the shooting and really the first hour, to get a strike team together or any kind of dedicated force up to the top of that tower. So what we ended up with are four men out on that tower deck to approach the sniper. The first one out the door is Ramiro Martinez, who's an off-duty cop who on his own volition ends up kind of running in a zigzag pattern to the tower, getting up the elevator and realizing he's the first one who has the idea to stick his head out the door onto that observation deck. He's joined by a bookstore manager, Alan Crum, who works at the University Co-op. And Crum is an Air Force veteran, and so he has some training, but he ends up in the tower through a series of circumstances, offers his help to Martinez, and in the last moments before going out on the deck, is deputized to help in any way he can. And then shortly behind Crum come Houston McCoy and Jerry Day, two other on-duty officers who had both been on campus for a while trying to figure out the best way to get up to the top of the tower, the best way to take on this menace. But a big part of the problem is that there was almost no communication available to these officers. In 1966 in Austin, police had radio units in their cars, but as soon as they left their car, they had no way to communicate with headquarters, with each other. And so they were all, you know, basically on their own.
And so they went in and they found the sniper, shot him, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, that's basically how it ended is, you know, Martinez exits a door on the tower observation deck that faces south, and he takes a blind left turn, poking his head around a corner, finds that the sniper is not on the east facet, and as he's making his way across the eastern wall of the observation deck, McCoy appears behind him with a shotgun. Martinez is thrilled to see that he's got backup, and that his backup has more than just a .38 revolver, which is what Martinez had on him. As the two men approach another turn, Martinez wheeled around the corner, spotted the sniper, and opened fire with his revolver. McCoy was behind him with a shotgun and blasted him as well, and they ended the siege.
This happens on the University of Texas campus. I recognize, you know, statues and steps and plazas, and so will anyone else who attended the campus or knows it. Has the university reacted to the film?
Yeah, it took a while. You know, going all the way back to my freshman year on campus, I took a tour my first day, and I asked about the tower shooting way back then in 1994. And I remember the campus tour guide kind of rolled her eyes, and she said, you know, we're really not supposed to talk about that. And that has been the attitude for all these many years. And so when we set out to make the film, we never asked the university for anything. We didn't ask for permission. We didn't shoot on campus. We didn't take advantage of relationships that might have opened doors to us because we didn't need anything from them. But as the film was getting completed and as we moved to premiere it, we knew that there were people at the university who were curious about what we were up to. And I think that they were probably concerned that this story might make them look bad or perpetuate something that they had been trying to keep quiet. But finally, after the film premiered at South by Southwest, a few months later, on the 50th anniversary of the tower shooting, we held a screening here in Austin at the Bob Bullock Texas History Museum, and the president of the university came to the screening, and he wrote me a really beautiful handwritten note thanking us for what we'd done. And I'm excited to say that in February, the university will officially be showing Tower on campus in an event that's free to all students. And I'm just amazed by that because that was one of our very original goals when we set out to make the film.
Keith Maitland, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you so much, Dave.
Keith Maitland directed the new documentary film Tower. It premieres on Independent Lens on PBS Tuesday, February 14th. Now we'll hear from our book critic Maureen Corrigan. George Saunders has long been celebrated for his short stories, which have appeared in publications including The New Yorker and Harper's. Saunders has just published his much-awaited first novel called Lincoln in the Bardo. Here's Maureen's review.
Willie Lincoln was only 11 when he died in February 1862 of typhoid fever. The Lincolns' third son was said to be their favorite, and after Willie was interred in a borrowed mausoleum in Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown, Abraham Lincoln returned to that cemetery several times. Newspapers reported that the president visited the crypt to open his son's coffin and hold his body. It's that image of Lincoln cradling the corpse of his beloved son in a pietà pose that inspires George Saunders' first novel called Lincoln in the Bardo. Though it's early days yet, I feel pretty safe in saying that this is going to be one of the year's most acclaimed novels. Lincoln in the Bardo is searing, inventive, and bizarre. This is George Saunders, after all, whose imagination effortlessly mashes together the hellfire visions of Hieronymus Bosch with crude middle school anatomical humor and the deadpan surrealism of Rod Serling. There's always method to Saunders' madness, and here it forces readers to realize, as if for the first time, the ultimate oddness of our own existence, namely, that there's an end to it, that we and everyone we love are going to die. The action of Lincoln and the Bardo is mostly confined within the iron gates of Oak Hill Cemetery, which still exists, by the way, in Georgetown. A voice, identified as one Hans Vollmann, opens the novel with a reminiscence. On our wedding day, Hans tells us, I was 46, she was 18. Another voice, that of one Elise Trainer, soon announces, I was too early departed. Saunders' chatty dead are stuck in what Tibetan Buddhists call the Bardo, a limbo-like state where the fears and desires they harbored when they were alive are magnified. Saunders goes on to amplify this central idea of being stuck. The newly interred Willie Lincoln is trapped in the Bardo by his yearning to keep seeing his father during those heartbreaking pilgrimages Lincoln pays to the crypt. Lincoln himself is stranded in grief. And of course, the nation finds itself stalled in a transitional state, mired in the blood and gore of the Civil War. The impossibility and yet the dire necessity of moving on are the opposing forces that wrestle with each other in this profound novel. If this overview makes Lincoln and the Bardo seem too static, too reminiscent of that sluggish classic Spoon River anthology, be assured that the wild plot swerves of Saunders' short stories have been transplanted and multiplied in his debut novel. Old Testament angels, who may be demons in disguise, pay the cemetery dwellers an apocalyptic visit. The ghosts of slaves rise up from their sick boxes, as the dead call their coffins, just outside the iron gates and integrate the lily-white Oak Hill Cemetery. And in a moving, climactic scene, the legions of the dead swarm the unknowing Lincoln when he visits Willie. Saunders speaks in 100 tongues here, concocting words like skimwalking to describe the peculiar way the dead navigate the cemetery and taking us deep into Lincoln's grief. Here are some of Lincoln's staccato thoughts as he sits in that mausoleum, holding Willie and grappling with his death and the mounting deaths of the Civil War. He is just one, and the weight of it about to kill me. Have exported this grief some 3,000 times. A mountain of boys, someone's boys, must keep on with it, may not have the heart for it. One thing bothers me about this extraordinary novel, more of a question really than a quibble. Throughout Lincoln and the Bardo, Saunders intersperses chapters packed with quotes from historical sources. He gives citations for these historical sources, and some are legit, like Doris Kearns Goodwin's book on Lincoln, for instance, but other sources are made up. All the historical passages are tossed together indiscriminately. It's not like Saunders is doing anything new here. Novelists have been playing with historical narrative since the term postmodern was invented. But I wonder if just in the past couple of months, our taste and tolerance for this kind of melding of fact and fiction has diminished. Like I say, it's a question. What's not a question is the achievement of Lincoln and the Bardo. Like the president who graces its pages, it's monumental.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. Bharati Mukherjee, an Indian-born American writer whose work explored the thoughts and experiences of immigrants from many countries, died last month in Manhattan. She was 76. Her short story collection, The Middleman and Other Stories, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. Mukherjee was born in Calcutta to a wealthy Hindu family. She went to schools in England, Switzerland, and India, including a convent school run by Irish nuns. She attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the 60s, where she studied with Philip Roth and met her husband, writer Clark Blaze. It wasn't the life her parents envisioned. They'd planned an arranged marriage for her. Terry spoke to Mukherjee in 2002 after her novel Desirable Daughters was published. It's about three daughters whose background is similar to Mukherjee's and about their approaches to some of their cultural traditions, including arranged marriages.
You were supposed to have an arranged marriage. Your parents had selected a man for you when you were, still a teenager and living in India. Had you asked them to do that, or did they just take that on themselves?
Oh, no, they took it upon themselves. There was never any question of expressing my wishes, ideas, politics. My father decided what we wore, what opinions we had on trivial and important things, and we simply mouthed them.
Well, how did you say no to your parents?
Impulse. I think very much like Tara, the narrator in Desirable Daughters, I found that the moment that I hit Iowa as a graduate student, that it was the beginning of the making of a consciousness, that I'd come out of such a protected world. I feel now, there was no bubble wrap in those days, but I feel now that in a way I was bubble wrapped in innocence and kept away from any kind of possibility of breaking rules or thinking bad thoughts. So that the moment I came here to the United States, it became an occasion for me to try out all the subterraneous personalities that I had learned to conceal from adults.
When you told your parents that you didn't want the arranged marriage, what was their reaction?
Actually, mine was even more dramatic or melodramatic than that. I sent a cable to my father saying, by the time you get this, I'll already be married. So there was very little that my wonderfully patriarchal father could do about the situation. I fell in love over a two-week courtship with a fellow student in the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, writer named Clark Blaze. That was 38 years ago, by the way. And we got married during a lunch break in the lawyer's office above the coffee shop. That lawyer's office is still there in Iowa City.
And you're still married.
And I'm still married.
So were your parents very angry with you? Did they accept that this was your choice and that you'd be happy?
They were devastated that I'd had the guts or the audacity to take a decision on my own. They'd never, never expected me to break any kind of parental rule. Or I'd been very careful not to expose my very emotional nature to them.
Your novel, Desirable Daughters, is about three sisters. One of them stays in India. Two of them come to America. Do you have any siblings who stayed behind in India?
I have one. My youngest sister stays in India.
Is her life and your life very different?
It's very much like the Parvati character. Her life is very much like that of the Parvati character in the novel, the one who stays in Bombay and is the wife of a senior corporate man. She has been the bridge, or made herself a bridge, between modern India traditions and at the same time rebelled against my father's choice of husband for her.
So she didn't have an arranged marriage?
No, none of us did. My poor father tried so hard, and each of us three sisters went our own ways.
Although you grew up in a Hindu family, you went to a convent school. Why would Hindu parents send you to an Irish Catholic convent school?
Oh, that was the pattern, certainly when I was going to school, that if you were what we called one of the best families in town, then you went to, if you were a girl, you went to Loretta House on Middleton Row, fancy formerly British area, to this convent run by Irish nuns from Galway. And if you were a male child, you were sent to St. Xavier's College, also in the same area, which was run by Jesuit priests from Belgium. And so we kept our school lives, where we celebrated St. Patrick's Day with shamrock flown out of Galway, and our Hindu home life, very, very separate.
So what exactly were the advantages of going to the convent school? Was it that you were getting a Western education? Or?
It was very hard to get into that school, and it was really about how respected your family was in town. And so going there meant you were assured excellent bridegroom prospects.
I see.
And, and good manners, and very well guarded. We were chaperoned all the time.
I see. I think, is it in your book you say that it also assured that you were going to be a virgin?
Yes, yes, absolutely. But it's just that all that was fraudulent, I realize now, that we kept the appearance of absolute purity and absolute innocence to the point of naivety. But there were rebellions going on, only you learned how to hide it.
Mm-hmm. When you came to the United States, what year was that?
1961, fall of 1961.
So you came to the United States and got married before the women's movement of the late 60s.
The movement, meaning Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook and Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, were just beginning to be read, 63 and so on. So I was very much here in the United States, as people were getting taking aggressive or self-assertive acts to equalize rights.
Now, as an inveterate reader and as a novelist, what are the books that really reached you that spoke about the woman's condition in the 60s and that inspired you to map out your life?
It was a mixture. I loved The Golden Notebook, but I also loved Emma Bovary and her misguided attempts to liberate herself from what I saw as a very provincial kind of repression of her free spirit. So it was everything combined, but the most important narrative to me was my own life, the experiences I was having. Because I was, while other women, my women friends, were throwing pots or trying out painting.
You're making pottery when you say throwing pots.
Yes, sorry. making pottery, going to art classes, you know, working with their hands, nice clay medium. And they were also going to consciousness-raising groups and examining themselves with mirrors and so on. I was, you know, too shy to look at my body. I still can't do those tests for finding, you know, tumors in one's breasts. I'm that not at ease with my body, I guess. And certainly the whole idea of consciousness raising, where you write down what the husband's duties are about taking out garbage or doing the gardening and who does the dishes when, all those kinds of things struck me as so irrelevant to my life, where Clark and I had small children. We were both going to school. I was getting my PhD. I was teaching full time and bringing up, going to the laundromat to clean diapers before going off to teach. That, you know, I had no time for that kind of thinking through a feminist agenda.
When did you know you wanted to write?
From age 3. I was a precocious child. And I lived in stories, inside stories.
Would your family have considered it acceptable for you to be a writer?
Because I was a woman, and as long as I wasn't writing anything that might be considered rude, such as sex, violence, it would be okay, yes. They thought of it as an accomplishment, womanly accomplishment. Gift of the pen is what the phrase they used.
And have you written about sex or things that are rude?
I'm afraid so. And for my characters, including Tara, sexuality becomes a favored way of expressing revolution, trying out a life outside the box.
Is it hard for you to write that way, since you said you're too uncomfortable to even do self-exams?
No. I think for me, my fiction is a way of getting in touch with my inner bad girl. And so, you know, I want in my fantasies to be a cross between Rita Hayworth and Diana Ross.
And not the Hindu convent girl.
No. And once I'm in that mode, you know, inside the character,
anything
goes. I can do bad things.
No, I've read that there was a period when you, of a few years when you lived in Canada. And that this
14 years, yeah.
And that overlap with the period when several thousand refugees left Idi Amin's Uganda, and about 5,000 of those refugees, people who were formerly, I think, from India.
They were second and third generation Ugandans of
Asian descent.
Asian, yes. And they had British passports, which mm-hmm. Britain did not honor. And so the Canadian Prime Minister of that time, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, very kindly offered them residence, green cards. And that caused a sudden, really unanticipated, at least by me, backlash against brown immigrants. And the government didn't react to control that backlash in the way that it should have.
Why do you think there was a backlash, and how did it directly affect you?
Oh, dear. It meant that anyone with a brown face in cities like Toronto, Vancouver, was fair game for physical harassment as well as verbal harassment on the street. And so, you know, there were incidents every day. And I was a victim of many such incidents of not being served in stores or being roughed up by teenagers in blue jeans overalls in subway, on subway platforms, or being, you know, thrown out of lobbies of fancy hotels if my white husband wasn't near me, or being given secondary examination in airports, or racial profiling. And there was no, in the Canada of those early 70s to late 70s, in fact, through the 70s, there was no constitution in Canada. The constitution hadn't yet been repatriated. And so there was no Bill of Rights. There was no legal agency of redress against race-based hate crime.
What must have been particularly odd for you during that experience in Canada, when you felt that there was a lot of backlash, you had come from a very elite family in Calcutta. Your family
yes.
was wealthy. You were among...
We were brought up to think well of ourselves and that our ideas mattered.
Right. So it must have been a very kind of educational experience to suddenly be perceived not as the elite, but as the inferior, and to have people, you know, even attacking you because of that. I'm sure you could use a lot
yes.
of words other than educational to describe that experience. But I'm sure someone like you really walked away from
it. It was
that
devastating.
Learning a lot, yeah.
Yes, it was totally, totally devastating to me to be seen as, you know, an unwanted Canadian, mm-hmm. as a smelly immigrant, a potential burglar and con artist and so on. And it made me reassess my status, my own attitudes towards minorities in India while I had been growing up, how unconsciously racist or ethnicist I may have been myself in relation to Indian minorities. And having been an elite in Calcutta, brought up to believe that my ideas matter meant that I had the gutsiness to take on government officials in Canada and say, you can't do this, this is not right, and I know what's right, and I'm jolly well going to tell you how to set it right. It didn't work, but, you know, I was caught in two simultaneous roles. One as someone who's very confident of herself and knows right from wrong and feels very strongly about civil rights, human rights, and the other who feels impotent that there'll be no change in the way that the country thinks. I'm so glad, though, over the years, I've been proved wrong and that Canada is a very habitable place.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bharati Mukherjee speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2002. Mukherjee died last month in Manhattan. She was 76. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.